I am starting a chronometer, so a timer, to make sure that I'll be giving this talk in exactly 45 minutes. I'll be standing so I can move and gesture more. Thank you very much for coming. When I was asked to give this talk a couple of months ago, and they asked me to go as third in the seminar series, so pretty early, I was like, yeah, no problem. I mean, I'm ready, because I've been working on these things for years. But what I wasn't expecting was that my ideas on these topics have been changing dramatically in the last 2 months of my permanence here at the VDPH, because VDPH has really came to be such a lively place for scholarly exchange. So this presentation, these ideas are, first, work in progress. Second, evolving work. Third, it's very much a child and a product of the discussions I've been having with many of you here present on these topics. On different occasions. So I wanted to thank Franz Fischer, Tiziana, and everyone at the VDPH for having me here as a visiting scholar, and for creating such an environment that's so hard to find in Italian academy, in which you can really exchange ideas. In a nutshell, what I'm going to talk to you about today will be, I work on digital scholarly editions. I will hint to the issue of diplomatic and normalized editions, so a diplomatic transcription of a manuscript or an inscription, and a normalized edition. And I will propose to use Hems Law, so structural linguistics, structuralist approach to digital modeling for pre-modern writing systems. I will discuss open issues, and then I will make a point that make the case that the best way to achieve interoperability, in my view, is through good modeling. Interoperability is an issue when you're creating an edition of a medieval manuscript, a cuneiform inscription, you're creating another edition, the alphabet isn't the same, the two editions don't talk to each other. My personal focus is on European medieval handwriting, so everything that comes before Gutenberg, handwriting or early print like Elisa Quagliana, imitating handwriting, but only working on alphabetic writing systems so far, so I'm sorry, cuneiform people. I only work on Latin script, Italian, English, Greek, Cyrillic. But I hope that my model can be expanded and can be exchanged with scholars working on other fields, such as Paola Farro, Massimo Iocchi, and the others, Stephen White, and the others who are working on other writing systems. Anything that's non-Gutenbergian, non-standard, needs good modeling. Okay, let's start straight away. Diplomatic versus normalized editions. Imagine this is an early modern age book, right? An incunabulum, Venenum. It's written like this. I can provide a diplomatic transcription in which, roughly, I try to reproduce the sign as they are on the page. I know that this sounds funny in Italian, but just say that this is a very rough way to say, because I can always give a representation of what's on the page, but I'm trying to imitate the signs on the page. Diplomatic transcription. I do this because of historical documentation of how it's written in that source, and for visualization. This can easily be visualized, but cannot be processed. So I need to give some sort of normalized representation of the text that we call normalized transcription, or normalized textual layer, for processing. Search. I cannot do string matching on this, because if I look for this word with B, I won't find it. For collation of two manuscripts, for natural language processing, you cannot run lemmatization on this, or for statistics such as distance reading. This is EVT, Edition Visualization Software, from Roberto Salier Turco's team. Here, the user can choose to read the diplomatic transcription or the interpretive normalized transcription. So, this is a line of a manuscript I've been working on for my previous edition, a medieval Latin grammarian, Ursus Beneventanus. This is what actual handwriting looks like. Diplomatic transcription. Comparatur, vel, ad se, vel, ad alium. Something can be compared to itself or to something else. Okay, so let's see if we can use structural linguistics, the School of Copenhagen, to help us model the text in a way that makes sense and can be exchanged among projects. This is a very basic concept we have to recall. You can conceive the text as a flowing, so as on the syntagmatic axis, as a series of sounds or a series of marks, graphical marks. This is what Hiemslow calls the syntagmatic axis or process. Or you can conceive the paradigmatic axis of language, the linguistic system. For instance, instead of well, I could have out. Instead of you, I could have y or l. Everything that you read in red color, these are words by Louis Trolle Hiemslow. So I'm using his terminology whenever it's red. Whenever it's black, it's my paraphrases, my own terms. To do the A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I was like, shall I do this? I won't do it. I did. So, and this is the text axis, which is a sequence, okay? Hiemslow, like most other linguists, are actually thinking of spoken language when they talk about the syntagmatic axis. They're talking about the sequence of phonemes. But we will discuss in a minute whether this can be applied to written representations of text, which is an issue. Okay, so Hiemslow proposes a method in a very important book that's a prolegomena to a theory of language, Italian Fundamenti alla teoria del linguaggio, Fundamenti della teoria del linguaggio. He says that the job of the linguist should be to do the linguistic analysis. Linguistic analysis consists in taking what's continuous and transforming it into something discrete, in identifying individual entities in the flowing of language. That's our friend. He says, if we're given anything as data, it is the as yet unanalyzed text in its undivided and absolute integrity. So to me, it looks like the kind of analysis, the kind of method that he's proposing, the theoretical framework he's proposing, is very much digital modeling. Because in its essence, digital modeling means identifying entities and functions between those entities. This, if we manage to model language and text that way, we can very easily implement this with technology, either with a database, XML, plain text, doesn't matter, whatever programming model you're using, but the model is digital if it's quantized. So you can identify entities in the text, or in the process, or in the system. Can we consider graphemes as entities? Can we apply this from phonetics, like Hiemslow does, to graphematics? Louis Trolle, Hiemslow, for instance, says in chapter 21 of the Prolegomena, the same linguistic form can be manifested in writing. Here, the substance is a graphic substance, not a phonetic, but a graphic substance. And it is our job to describe the actually present expression. In other words, he's giving us a blessing and say, okay, my friends, you can go, because the same form can be expressed with sounds, with the writing, or another substance of the expression. So when we're modeling pre-modern writing systems, we have a number of issues, such as making discrete what's naturally continuous. Ligatures, allographs, graphemes, defining the grapheme set, punctuation, abbreviations. Let's see if we can use structural linguistics, he calls it glossematic, for this. The first check is on discrete. The very model is made to make the analogic, to transform it into discrete. Okay, let's talk a little bit about his terminology. He talks about a sequence of entities are called a chain, and a series of entities in the system are a paradigm. So you can have a paradigm of all the letters that are used, a paradigm of all the sounds, a paradigm of all the variants of a sound. One issue here is that Hiemslow talks about a chain that is a sequence. Also in information studies, a chain is a sequence. But in handwriting, not everything is a sequence. For example, you can have an abbreviation mark that's superimposed, for example. We'll see in a minute that this is an issue in his theory. Okay, the second aspect of Hiemslow's structuralist approach, the first pillar is entities. The second pillar is functions. A functional analysis of the functional relationship between entities. So two entities can entertain a function. An example is a ligature. This is tu, comparatur. These are two different entities that enter a specific function, a specific relationship. You can use this to tackle the issue of ligatures. Ligatures can be considered a specific function in which two entities, two parts of a chain, red is always Jens Blow's terms, and enter a specific function. What's interesting about this conceptual framework is that Hemsel says that when an entity enters a function with another, one selects the other. For example, this shape of T is very strange, right? Doesn't it look like an epsilon? But this is the variant of T that you always find when it's in connection with U. And this is a strange U. It's the same U that you find when you have this ligature. And this is perfectly mirrored by the concept of function. He also says that the variants that you find in a function, in a chain, are called varieties. Varieties are solidal variants. Okay, good. So no high tide so far. This is the news from the tide alert. So in this case, this variant selects the other variant, and all of them, they're solidal, meaning that all of them are necessary. You need to have two of them to have a ligature, which makes sense. So ligatures can be modeled this way. Things become more interesting to me when we go to allographs. The distinction between graphemes and allographs. Allographs are variants of graphemes. So let's imagine the paradigm of all possible graphemes. All graphemes that can be found in a position of a chain. These two of those entities enter a function which he also calls commutation. Imagine this other case. We have three different variants, three different allographs of the same grapheme, which is the T. The T grapheme can be written in three different shapes, three different forms. I'm using this notation for graphemes and this notation for allographs or variants. Jenslow says that if you switch two signs and you have a change in meaning, then the function is a commutation. Commutation is a switching of entities on the paradigmatic axis in the system that changes the meaning of the word. For example, annus, annis, the word is changing. However, if you can switch the two signs in the system and you have no change in meaning, then he calls this a substitution. This function is a substitution. So this is datur, this is still datur. Comparatur, 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 the meaning is the same. We're not talking about phonetics, just to repeat what Steve was saying. We don't need phonetics here. In the linguistic system, if we switch one of the signs, the linguistic meaning is changing. This test is important to distinguish between what are variants from what are invariants. In this case, these two are variants of the same invariant, because if you switch them, you have substitution. That meaning doesn't change. This is very useful to us to distinguish between graphemes, invariant, and allographs, variants. T is a grapheme, because if you change it with switch it with another grapheme, the meaning changes. Those three allographs are variants. These are allographs because the commutation test doesn't work. You can switch, and you don't have the change in meaning. Okay, scholarly digital editions have an issue. When you're transcribing a manuscript, you have a lot of variants. What shall I translate? What shall I transcribe? What shall I include in my digital representation? Shall I include the difference between the different T's, the differences in punctuation, the difference in ligatures, or not? Obviously, you choose whatever is good for you for the scientific needs of your edition. If some allograph is important from the cultural point of view, you obviously include it. But what I think is that this is a common theoretical framework that we can all share, we can all agree upon, to distinguish what's a grapheme from what's an allograph. And having this been said, we call graphemes graphemes, allographs allographs, and then you declare what you are encoding. You can declare, I'm encoding only graphemes, except for the T thing, because it has a cultural significance. It helps me to date the manuscript. As I said, working on modeling and declaring this modeling and having a formal modeling can help us to declare what you are doing to build software that's shared because it's based on a common model, on a shared model. So I think that with the commutation test, we have three more checks, allographs and capitalization. Manuscripts often have capitalization as an allograph, but not always. Because, okay, now I need a book to do a choreographic thing, but that book is holding the camera, so I can't take it.
No.
Okay. Over here, capitals don't make a difference in meaning, so they are variants. Allographs. But if we have body and body, body capital, body lowercase, it does make a difference. So in that case, there's another concept from structural linguistics, it's called neutralization, that I won't have time to discuss here. I'm just saying that if we all refer to the same theoretical framework, we can build shared models. Punctuation, here is Elisa Cugliano, with whom I've been talking about this, and then I prepared 5 slides only for you, which is,
we're discussing,
which is, and for everybody else who's interested in punctuation. So, you can say that if I change a comma, the meaning of the word doesn't change. The point is that Louis Stroller never talks about change of meaning, he talks of content form, and never talks about words. What's funny about this book, The Prolegomena to the Theory of Language, is that he never mentions the word word. Never, ever. He's a linguist. The meaning that changes can be the meaning of larger units, such as sentences. So, for example, okay, imagine, I was saying, imagine I'm Jesus. No, imagine Jesus is saying, in the Gospel, truly I tell you, this is a passage of the Gospel, truly I tell you, today you will be with me in the paradise. With comma. Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. This is an actual case of a dispute between two religious confessions that have different interpretations. Because, truly I tell you, this means that we go to paradise the same day of our death. This doesn't imply it. So the meaning of the whole sentence changes based on a change, on a switch, in a piece of punctuation. So in this case, punctuation is a grapheme. But not all punctuation is a grapheme. Because some punctuate, a comma can have different shapes. In my Ursus manuscript, I had 3 different types of comma, middle dot, looking like each other. So we can still use the commutation test. Does it change the meaning or not? This is slippery ground, but I think this is the way forward, the way that we can apply check, even to punctuation. When we go to abbreviations, everybody who's been working with manuscripts is shredding. Because, shivering, we know that this is the complicated issue. Abbreviations. We're good with timing. Yes. Okay, comparator. This is an abbreviation. How can we bundle it? One approach... Oh, first off, I know this looks very theoretical, but if you're preparing a project, an encoding text that is not Gutenbergian, you are finding solutions to these issues. However, you find your own solution, which is different from his solution and her solution. And we hardly have a discussion on those issues based on real methodological thinking. Okay, so one approach is, as Steve said, you can consider the whole thing as one grapheme. The commutation test works, because if I switch all with hook, all with macron, etc., the meaning changes. However, Louis Stroller says, the analysis should be guided by principles, the simplicity principle, the economy principle, the reduction principle. Basically, he says that we should use the lowest possible number of elements to create a system. So this system has a huge number of elements. So I think that the second approach is encoding abbreviation through 2 entities that enter a function, that have a relationship with each other, a functional relationship with each other. There's still one thing, the function is one thing, but they have a relationship. Let me make a parenthesis on this. I'm not mentioning possible technological implementations. But everybody who knows informatics, at least a little, like I know them, I know informatics a little, easily understands that as long as you have 2 entities and a function between them, you can implement this with different technologies. You can have a database in which those 2 IDs have a relationship in the database. You can have XMLTI, in which you have 1 element with 2 children. You can have plain text files with light markup, with external annotation, all right? The technology doesn't matter as long as the model is the same. Okay, let's go ahead. So if we consider those 2 entities which enter a function, which function is it? Is it like the ligature, like 2 solidal variants? It looks like it could be, but there is an issue. Solidal variance means that both solidal variants means that both are mandatory. Do you remember the TU ligature? If you take the U off, there's no ligature. If you take the T off, there's no ligature. Both of them are mandatory. This is the meaning of solidal in Hell's Law. Obviously, that's not the case. Because the O is a constant. It's mandatory. But the hook is optional. So this is not a good modeling. We have a different relationship in which the O governs the hook, meaning that the O must be there, the hook can be there or not be there. This is what Hobbes calls a selection function. Selection means that this is like the principal clause in a sentence, this is like the secondary clause in a sentence. That's better, and I think that's the solution. However, as I said, Hobbes considers a selection a function within a chain. This is a definition of a selection. However, this is not a chain. There's no sequence. Which comes first, the O or the hook? They are somehow related. So one possible solution to this is a complicated thing, which is called complementarity, which is long to explain, and I won't have time to explain here, but it looks like it's two different paradigms that entertain a relationship with each other. One base grapheme and one abbreviation mark. They can be zero, and both of them are mandatory. So I won't annoy you with this any longer, just saying that I'm indecided between those two things. And transcript and abbreviations is one of the open issues in every theory of transcription, including Klaus Hutfeld. There's a brilliant article that I knew, the one you mentioned, but they make a shipwreck when it comes to abbreviations. That's where they can't really model it, and me neither. Abbreviations are an open issue. They're tricky. Okay, open issues, and then my conclusions. So we're almost done. So open issues are the modeling of abbreviations as functions between two elements. What's the nature of this function? They're no diacritics. In diacritics, the linguistic meaning is mostly carried by the base grapheme. If I say, ancora, and I put a stress on the A, ancora is still ancora. But in this case, the letters change, the meaning changes. Okay, a second issue is the one-to-many relationship in abbreviations. Normally, so far, we have seen functions between elements that have a one-to-one relationship. One allograph can be substituted by another allograph. One allograph refers to one grapheme, etc. However, here we have two graphemes that can be substituted by two different graphemes. The hook doesn't mean M. It can mean N or whatever else. Or 2 to 4. Or 1, 2, 3. This is one grapheme. So, in my previous reflection on this, and this is a talk that I gave 2 years ago here with Antonio Montefusco, I created a model that I implemented in my Ursus Beneventanus edition, in which I made a distinction between the concept of grapheme and the concept of alphabetical letter, or alphabeme. So I said that one grapheme can mean three different alphabemes. This is a complication of the system that worked very well, but it's very complex and cumbersome. And I'm still, as I said, I'm still working on this. So this is, for me, a very open issue. This pillar of my theory is shaking. Third issue, ligatures. Is this one grapheme or a ligature of two graphemes? What's for one? You're already sleeping, huh? You have your eyes open, now you're already sleeping. I don't blame you. The thing is that today it's one grapheme, ampersand. But originally, historically, it was two graphemes, a ligature of E and T, et, which is, so, it's no longer the case today. So, however, this is a manuscript of the 10th century, Middle Ages. Where does the scribe stand? Did he think of two graphemes or one grapheme? I can only, and in my digital modeling, this has a consequence. It's either one character or two characters. Either one element in my database or two elements in my database. It's either one TI element or two. If I have to base myself on historical etymological considerations, I am on slippery ground. Am I going to enter the mind of the scribe, what he was thinking? However, I see no way out. This is the only way I can do it, and that's an open issue to me. This is another complex issue. The definition of what is a grapheme, the distinction between a grapheme and another, grapheme. Oh, it's very early, so I can keep going for 30 minutes. No, okay, I'm finishing earlier, so you're getting your train. So, look at this. We have a, say, full stop, okay? It has two different usages. This is the expression, this is the content. Significant, significat. Okay. it has two different meanings, very distant from each other. It can be a full stop or an abbreviation. Franz, you suggested this kind of case when we exchanged a couple of emails. Okay, is this one sign with a very large meaning, one expression, one content, broad content? It's just, okay, in Spanish, you can say padres, which means parents or fathers. So it has a broad meaning. In Italian, padre has a narrower meaning. Right? Is this a case it has a broader meaning? Or there are two different signs that look like each other? Hiemslow hoped that we could fix those issues by making a structural analysis of the meaning. He said that boy can be analyzed into human, male, young. But this is the part of his thought that's been most harshly criticized. It's very hard to analyze that meaning based on structural considerations. So I think that this is an open issue. It's for you to decide whether you want to assign, to encode it with one ID or with two different IDs, with one entity or two entities, with one database entry or two database entries. The last issue is allograph definitions. Even defining the allograph is an issue from a theoretical point of view, and that's a very tricky one, probably the most tricky. But I think that the solution is in Hiemslow. It's called metasemiology. And if I tell you metasemiology, you're probably thinking, metasemiology. Sounds bad, but it's actually quite simple. Hiemslow says, okay, these are variants, okay, allographs. How many are they? Three. Easy. However, in truth, Hiemslow says, if I write T 100 times, I have 100 different T's. And in structuralist thought, they're all variants of the same grapheme, all right? How do I group all those into one type? Based on meaning, the commutation test, impossible. The commutation test doesn't change, because from here to here to here, the meaning doesn't change in any case. So Hiemslow says something which looks scary, it's quite simple. Whenever you can use the commutation test, switching, changing of meaning, it's semiology. Beyond that, it's meta-semiology, like physics, metaphysics. So he says, in this case, you can only use other sciences that are not linguistics, such as statistics, right? And that's what we can do with AI. If you're applying AI to this, and AI is identifying a pattern, basically it's statistics, right? So Hiemslow has already thought of this. So these are my open issues, mostly having to do with abbreviation, ligatures, and the definition of graphemes and allograph. I think that these issues are open. I have 7 more months to go for my scholarship, and I'll be working on this. I keep talking to you about these things, waiting for your feedback. But let me make a final point. Why did I say in the Tower of Babel? Every manuscript speaks a different language, a different writing system. And we are encoding them historically, so with diplomatic transcriptions. But what's funny is that even our normalized transcriptions have those issues. If I'm encoding classical Latin, what's more normal than classical Latin? It's the standard of all standards. However, the Loeb editions of classical Latin texts have the UV distinction. The Teubner edition, which editions are very scientific, don't have the UV distinction. So they're speaking two different dialects. So even then, so if I'm performing cross-corpus search, natural language processing, distant reading, based on things that are written with different systems, I do have an issue. How do the digital humanities work on this? With disposable homemade solutions, project-specific solutions. You have to tackle those issues. You have to, but you tackle them at home. And you hardly ever document what you're doing. So whether you're modeling a writing system or you're doing normalization software, normalization models such as those made, for instance, by Elena Spadini. She's been talking about this. Elena Spadini talked to me about this in the lunch break of the Bari IUCD conference. In the lunch break, she was like, you know, we're doing this. We're doing this our way. And then we went to lunch. We didn't have a talk at the conference about those things. We talked at lunchtime. What's the way out of the tower to me? And that's my last slide. Is through scholarly discussion on modeling, through documenting our project-specific model in a formal way, such as data models, ontologies, software code tables, you know, sharing your model. This can bring to shared models, not the other way around. It's not like one ring to conquer them all, right? Let's impose a model, the IUCD model. Let's discuss about models. And when we have shared models, then we can have reusable software libraries. Only if we're based on a common methodological reflection. And there's one question that you can ask. And that's the last one, I guess. Is it the last one? Yes, it's the last one. The real last one. You can say, just use Unicode. Why are you making all those issues, all those problems? TI says, just use Unicode. Unicode is interoperable. Question. This is a solution for new digital texts, for sure. If I'm producing new text with my computer, Unicode is great. However, it's not enough for pre-modern writing systems. Let's talk about three examples, very shortly. Ligatures. If I'm encoding this ligature with the Unicode code point, there's even an ASCII code point for this. That's so easy. Have I encoded this equivalent to E plus T in that manuscript? I didn't. Allograph. There are code points for short S and long S. One is even ASCII. Have I encoded their variants of grapheme S? Can I perform cross-corpus search? Not quite. I need software for that. And software must be based on a model that knows and represents that these are variants. Grapheme set. U. What's more normal than U? A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Right? U. U even has ASCII. However, if I use U, this code point, have I encoded whether it covers U and V or not? Okay, in a nutshell, I'm done. What I talked to you about is the issue of diplomatic normalized editions. Mostly diplomatic is what I care about right now. Yeltsov's analysis can be used as a theoretical framework, I believe, for discussing digital modeling of pre-modern writing systems because he is a structuralist, so he's naturally born digital. I discussed some open issues. I think that interoperability can be really achieved. It's a long-term achievement. Not entirely achievable, but we can walk in that direction through good modeling. Thank you for your attention. I'm looking forward to your feedback.